Hello and welcome to the Best of Science World. Today we'll feature some of the most interesting conversations we've had on our program's one-on-one segments. We'll hear why nightmares pack a greater emotional impact than simply having a bad dream. A Virginia Tech scientist tells us about his much more precise method to name and classify all of Earth's living organisms. Most of us have heard about Einstein's theory of relativity, but what is it? A scientist will give us an explanation. And why has Earth remained habitable despite a history of violent geologic change, while others that went through the same changes have become uninhabitable? We'll talk with a scientist who says he knows why. So stay with us for this special edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Canadian researchers released a study that shows nightmares indeed have a greater emotional impact than simply having a bad dream. Dr. Antonio Zadra was one of the researchers involved with the study, and he tells us what he and his colleagues learned about dreams and nightmares. Are there differences between bad dreams and nightmares?
Yes, actually there are, and it's one that can be best understood in terms of intensity. Nightmares are really disturbing dreams that awakens the sleeper. So usually we wake up startled, relieved that the experience was just a dream, and the awakening can be tied in directly to what was going on in the nightmare. Bad dreams are also highly disturbing, but we tend to remember them later on in the day or when we wake up with an external device like the alarm clock. So there's no temporal relation between the content of the dream and us waking up from it in the case of bad dreams.
You found that nightmares have more of an emotional impact than bad dreams. How so?
The nightmares end up giving rise to added distress than bad dreams do. And also when we ask people to rate the intensity of emotions that they experience within the dreams, nightmares come out as being much more emotionally intense than do bad dreams overall. And bad dreams, of course, are much more intense than your everyday mundane dream experience.
When I think about having a nightmare or a bad dream, one emotion I mostly think of is fear. What other emotions are played on by these dreams?
Well, one finding, which is might be quite surprising to people, is that about 35% of all nightmares and over half of bad dreams contain primary emotions other than fear. And these can be sadness, guilt, confusion, anger. So nightmares can intensify a broad range of negative emotions, although fear does remain the primary one.
What do most people have nightmares or bad dreams about? I understand that you and your colleague analyzed plenty of nightmares and bad dreams. So is there a general theme?
Yes. If we look at what are the most common themes, and we examined close to 10,000 dream narratives that people collected in the course of our study. And so one of the most frequently reported themes involves physical aggressions, also interpersonal conflicts where the person is having an intense argument or is being humiliated by either a coworker or a family member, things of that nature. Themes related to failure or helplessness, health-related concerns, being told, for instance, that you are about to die because you have cancer or learning of someone's death. And themes that most people might think about as being your typical nightmare, because that is what is often shown in novels and movies, the theme of being chased is actually relatively rare, occurring about 10% of nightmares and about 5% of all bad dreams. And then you have others. You can have the presence of evil forces, accidents, disasters, whether it's a flood, war, insects, things of that nature.
Are there differences in these dreams between gender and age groups?
One fascinating thing is that there are significant differences between the nightmares of men and women. So whereas themes relating to disasters and calamities are much more common in men's nightmares than women, whereas nightmares involving interpersonal conflicts are twice as frequently reported by women in their nightmares. And again, these are often centered around conflicts with coworkers, family members, spouse, friends, things of that nature.
Whenever I see literature about interpreting dreams, there's symbolism involved. What role does symbolism play in these dreams?
Well, one thing that is quite fascinating is that whereas everyday dreams really can cover a wide, broad spectrum of different contents, as the dream becomes more and more intense, the themes it represents gets more restricted. And so we see a more restricted range of themes in bad dreams, and this range becomes even further restricted in nightmares, such that most of these highly negative and intense dreams involve threats to survival, security, or self-esteem.
Professor, when we usually think of dreams, both good and bad, we think of it as a kind of a cinema of the mind while we're asleep, more of a visual experience. Could other senses or feelings be used to manifest a bad dream or nightmare?
Absolutely. And so, as you correctly point out, most dreams are inherently visual, but they're also auditory. We hear people scream, talk to us. We can hear a sirens or a dog barking, things of that nature. But in rare instances, we can also feel physical pain. We can have tactile sensations. We can feel the cold or warmth around us. And we can also have sensations in about 1% of dreams of either tasting things or olfactory sensations. For instance, walking into a bakery and being able to smell the wonderful aromas from that fresh bread or croissant coming out of the baker's oven.
I know you've probably been asked this question a number of times, but why do we have bad dreams or nightmares? Is it physically based on such things as eating a heavy meal before bedtime, or emotionally based, such as having a guilty conscience or perhaps an unidentified fear?
I think we can probably put to rest the idea that having the pepperoni pizza before going to bed induces nightmares. The heavy meal and so on, what it might do is cause us to have indigestion, might cause us to wake up during the night, and thus maybe more likely to remember a dream that we would have otherwise forgotten. But by and large, many nightmares tend to occur in periods where people are under stress, whether this is work-related, whether people are undergoing inner relationship issues, financial circumstances. So in periods of stress or where we doubt ourselves, where we feel insecure, tend to be the periods where nightmares are more likely to occur. That being said, having the occasional nightmare appears to be a universal experience, and thus that in and of itself is not something unusual or something to be worried about.
That was Dr. Antonio Zadra from the Department of Psychology at Canada's University of Montreal.
You're listening to The Best of Science World on The Voice of America.
Scientists today rely on the Linnaean system, a 200-year-old biological classification system, to help them keep track of every living organism on Earth. But if a new system developed by Dr. Boris Vanatzer from Virginia Tech catches on, researchers could have a much more precise way in naming and classifying all living organisms on Earth. Boris Vanatzer tells us about his new biological classification system and the benefits it could provide. Could you give us a little bit of an overview of your new system?
You know, we have had the Linnaean system to classify and to name biological organisms now for hundreds of years, and it's a really good system, right? It works really well as long as we talk about organisms that we can actually distinguish from each other, so that we can group them together and describe them as groups. Species. However, in the last few years with the new DNA sequencing technology, now we can actually distinguish every single organism within a species. And of course, Linnaeus did not predict that, and there is no system currently that we can use to systematically name organisms or strains that belong to the same species. In many real-world applications, we need to describe groups of organisms that look and behave exactly the same. Just for example, in the case of pathogens mainly, because within the same species, for example, Bacillus anthracis that causes anthrax, you know, all those bacteria that are in that species, they cause anthrax. They're very similar in how aggressive, how deadly they are. However, we still can distinguish them based on their genome sequence. And it's important to distinguish them because they belong to different populations. And if one of them causes a disease outbreak, we need to have some way to refer to that group within Bacillus anthracis that caused that disease outbreak. If then we have another disease outbreak, we want to know, is it caused by that same population or the same genetic lineage as the other outbreak or a different one?
Now, I understand that your new system is meant to enhance and add depth to the naming convention developed by Linnaeus. How so?
For example, all the dog breeds belong to the same species. However, of course, dogs are all different. The different breeds have different names. But the names do not indicate how the breeds are related to each other. Instead, the system we propose based on the genome sequence of each breed would get a code that reflects how the different breeds are related to each other. And that then could have a practical application that if you, in the future, buy a breed of dog, most likely you will have the sequence, the genome sequence of that breed, because it will, in the future, be very, very cheap. And so if then each breed is defined by the range of codes that are assigned to that breed based on our system, then you can get a code for your dog, and you can have a certificate that says, yes, this particular dog belongs to this breed.
With your system in place, will life forms already named and classified retain their current scientific names and classifications?
Oh, yes, for sure. The system is not intended at all to replace species names. It really complements the species names.
When you're applying genetics to the new naming convention and classification system, do you use the entire genome sequence or just a portion of it?
For viruses or bacteria, it is very easy today already to use the whole genome. For eukaryotes that reproduce sexually, there are problems. Once, of course, higher organisms have usually very large genomes, and then it becomes computationally very intensive to even calculate how similar two genomes are. However, animals, they have a diploid genome. We get a copy from father and a copy from the mother. So if you want to describe, give names to different animals, based on the similarity of the whole genome, it becomes complicated because we have two copies. Every animal has two copies of a genome. So how can you do that? Examples that we use in our paper is that we can use the mitochondrial genome, which is already used to understand the relationship between different human populations or different other animal populations. Only using the genome of the mitochondrion, which is always inherited from the mother. So we only have one copy of the mitochondrial genome. It's much easier. It's a smaller genome. There's only one copy per animal. And so we could use the mitochondrial genome to assign codes, humans or animals or plants.
Professor, could you give us an example of what would be named under your system?
We propose that every organism, a bacterium, or a virus that's sequenced gets a code based on its similarity to the most similar organism that has already a sequenced genome. And the whole code probably would be very long and would not be used in daily communication. It will have like 24 different positions. Maybe one population would be 0x2y, and the other population would be 0x3y. In the praxis, for the case of a human disease outbreak or plant disease outbreak, where we have the need to use a consistent name, for example, doctors and health officials have one name they can use as soon as there's a disease outbreak because we have a code and that code will stay the same, then it becomes very important to use our system.
That was Dr. Boris Vanatzer from the Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, or Virginia Tech, in Blacksburg, Virginia. Next year will mark the 100th anniversary of the 1915 publication of Albert Einstein's General Theory of Relativity. While many of us are familiar with the classic equation E equals mc squared, what did Einstein mean by a theory of relativity, and why are his theories still among the most important in science today? Biophysicist, astrophysicist, and author Dr. Jeffrey Bennett explains. I've heard so much about Einstein's theory of relativity, but frankly, I'm kind of fuzzy on the word relativity and why there's a theory about it. Can you please explain what this is?
The name relativity comes from the idea that motion is relative. And the way I like to think about that is imagine, you know, if you're running on a treadmill, the treadmill readout might say you're going 10 kilometers per hour, but you're not actually going anywhere. So what does that mean? That 10 kilometers per hour is your speed relative to that mat on the treadmill. But relative to the room that you're in, your speed is zero. But then you can take it further. Ask if someone was standing on the moon looking at you, how fast would they say you were going? Well, in that case, they would see you moving with Earth's rotation at a speed of around 1,000 or more kilometers per hour, depending on your latitude. So different observers will have different views of your motion, and it's that relativity of motion that gives the theory its name. Now, unfortunately, the real heart of the theory doesn't come from the relative part. That part is actually somewhat obvious to most people. It's the fact that Einstein showed that two things are constant in nature, and that's that the laws of nature are the same for everyone, and that everyone always measures the same speed of light. So I like to talk about that as the absoluteness of the speed of light. So I would have preferred if it had been called the theory of absoluteness, but you can see how it got its name, relativity.
Next year will mark the centennial of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is the second of two of his theories of relativity. 10 years prior to that, back in 1905, he issued his theory of special relativity. Are these two theories of relativity different from each other, and if so, how?
They're not different from each other in the sense that what Einstein was trying to do in both cases was the same thing. He was trying to find a way of explaining what happens with this idea of relative motion, and he realized that under our ordinary intuition about motion, things get really weird as you start to approach the speed of light. And special relativity gets its name special because it applies to the special case in which we do not deal with the effects of gravity. And so what Einstein found was that it was easier to do the work without worrying about gravity. So that's why special relativity came first. When he wanted to add in gravity, it turned out to be much more difficult, and it took him another 10 years to work out all the details.
What I think is really interesting is how well Einstein's theories have held up. I mean, over the years since he developed these theories, there have been a number of scientists who have been doing their very best to try to disprove them, and so far have been unsuccessful. Why do you think that is?
The theories work really well, and that's kind of an amazing thing. You know, the way science works is you always look for places where the theory might not work quite right so that you can find a better theory that improves upon it. And in fact, that's exactly what Einstein's general theory of relativity did for gravity compared to Newton's earlier theory of gravity. Newton's theory works great for almost all circumstances, but when the gravity gets really strong, it doesn't work perfectly anymore, and that's where Einstein's theory comes in and works better. So people have said, well, where are the holes in Einstein's theory? You know, what are the things it doesn't quite work for? And so far, every time someone's come up with an idea of where it might not work, and then we've gone out and tested it, it's turned out it does work. So as far as why, well, I guess he hit the nail on the head, so to speak. He really did a good job with that theory. There is probably eventually going to be something found that doesn't perfectly work with it, but so far we have not been able to find that.
I understand that Einstein had a problem with quantum physics, and I understand also that there may be a possibility that Einstein's theory may not work on the quantum level.
That's a very good point. So the theory of quantum physics is, in a sense, our theory of how nature works on the very, very small level, whereas general relativity is our theory of how it works on the very, very large level. And both those theories have passed every test that they've been put to date. What we do know, however, is that there are places where they seem to give different answers. And the key place is what we call the singularity of a black hole, so what would be in the center of a black hole. And at that point, quantum mechanics and general relativity say different things should be happening. So they can't both be right. We know that. What we can't do, unfortunately, is figure out a way so far to test which one is right or whether neither of them are right. So that's one of the things that theoretical physicists are working on today, trying to find a way to test new ideas that might bring these two theories together and take away this disagreement that they have at the singularity of a black hole.
That was biophysicist, astrophysicist, and author Dr. Jeffrey Bennett.
This is the best of Science World on VOA.
Scientists from California and China have developed a new theory that explains why Earth has remained habitable despite having the same kind of natural events that have gone on to rob other planets in our solar system of their ability to host and sustain life. Mark Torres from the University of Southern California was the lead author of the study, and he tells us about his team's research and findings. First of all, can you tell me what the Goldilocks principle is?
Oh, so the idea is there needs to be a certain amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. If you have too much, the Earth will get warm and get too hot. If you have too little, the Earth will get too cold, and also the organisms that use CO2 to photosynthesize, like plants, will not have enough CO2 to grow. So CO2 needs to be within a certain range in order for life to be happy at Earth's surface.
So the new hypothesis that you and your team developed explains why Earth has remained habitable for millions of years. Now, what does your theory say about that?
So the general idea is minerals react with water and atmospheric gases at Earth's surface. And since some minerals sequester CO2 or remove CO2 from the atmosphere, you can have an effect where if you supply more of those minerals to Earth's surface through uplifting a mountain, you might draw down CO2 from the atmosphere to levels that are too low for life on Earth. What we're saying is that, well, there's another reaction that occurs, that some minerals release CO2, and this effect is more pronounced in mountain ranges. So even if you uplift a mountain, you are not going to draw down CO2 so much that it'll affect life, that there'll be this additional release that helps keep things in balance.
What causes this release of CO2?
Minerals rich in reduced sulfur, like pyrite, it's also known as fool's gold, they react with oxygen, and it causes a reaction that produces strong acids, like sulfuric acid. Strong acids react with other minerals, and this leads to CO2 release.
Can you tell us about your research?
The project got started while we were doing some field work in Peru, and we noticed that the reaction of pyrite or fool's gold with oxygen was really important in this environment, but it was not important when we got down into the Amazon floodplain. So this motivated us to see, well, is that globally true? Does that exist in other environments? And so we took existing data for sites like the Himalayas, the mountains in Taiwan, and mountains in Canada, compiled it and found that, yes, it was sort of a global observation, that in mountain ranges you do have a lot of CO2 release because of the reaction of pyrite. And so we thought, well, if that's sort of important in the modern budget, would that be important over million-year timescales? So we looked at the record of marine rocks and their chemistry. This is a sensitive recorder of changes in ocean chemistry. And we sort of did some numerical computer models to compute how much pyrite was reacting over the course of the last 60 million years or so to sort of look at what effect it would have on the global carbon budget.
I know that there are other such sponges in the environment, such as the soil itself and, of course, trees and the ocean. Do these factors also have a self-regulating ability within them?
Yes, except it's all on different timescales. So the ocean, trees, and soils exchange carbon with the atmosphere on shorter timescales relative to what we're talking about, but still long timescales, sort of, you know, in the orders of thousands of years. Sort of looking at the exchange between the atmosphere and the rocks is maybe on the order of millions of years. So they all do affect the CO2, but on different characteristic timescales.
And finally, there's been a lot of concern lately, of course, about too much man-made atmospheric CO2 and other greenhouse gases. Does your theory indicate that Earth's natural climate regulator can also do the same with these current increasing levels of greenhouse gases?
Yes, but again, there's a timescale issue. So while Earth's natural cycles will sort of start interacting with our anthropogenic emissions, the timescale of these balancing, you know, reactions occurs over millions of years. So if we emit a bunch of CO2, we'll have to, you know, have it be in the atmosphere for a million years before anything happens. So all of the negative effects of anthropogenic emissions, like increased temperatures, ocean acidification, will still be a problem for, you know, humans. And so I think that's the main concern with the sort of anthropogenic emissions.
That was researcher Mark Torres from the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed looking back at a few of our more memorable one-on-one segments on the Best of Science World. But before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. There you'll find stories, program information, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The Best of Science World has been produced at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.